Moderate success. I'll tell you what, around here, that's it's considered smashing. We are considering the New Testament, or excuse me, the intertestamental period. I am ready to get into the New Testament. Like I joked about last week, we are on session four of a two-week session. Talking about the intertestamental period, because we are between the testaments in our Bible survey. And just a reminder, there are two major reasons that we have seen fit to do this, and by we, I mean Sean and I. Remember, Sean talked me into this. He created a monster. You give a history major license to talk about history in his Sunday school class, and this is what happens. Yeah, church made the mistake of putting two history majors with their offices facing each other in one corner of the church. Disaster waiting to happen. We are setting the stage for the New Testament, though. Historically, it's important for us to understand the historical context in which the New Testament lies. The second thing that we are looking at is the fact that prophecy is really awesome, because in the book of Daniel, God has seen fit to give us the history of the intertestamental period and really the rest of the history of the world before the fact, right? We've seen a couple of different visions and prophecies in the book of Daniel that outline the flow of the historical kingdoms as they are related to the nation of Israel before the fact. Before the fact. In fact, this and these visions and prophecies are so accurate that secular historians who say, this always killed me in school, we can't just invoke God in the Bible and in history. So what they're saying is, we're going to look at the Bible, but we're going to pretend that God had nothing to do with writing it. And so they assume that Daniel had to have been written during the Roman period, because they look at all of the things that happened in the visions, and they are so accurate that they say, well, this couldn't have been said, this couldn't have been written before these things happened. But we've seen Babylon, 612 to 539 BC. Now, to be fair, Babylon is technically not intertestamental, because we saw them in the Old Testament. Then we saw the Medo-Persian Empire, which was in the major power in the region in the world from 539 to 334 BC. We spent a couple of weeks then looking at the Greek Empire, particularly first Alexander the Great, who was deserving of his moniker. He was really great. He captured the entire world. He conquered essentially the entire known world. Excuse me, by the time he was 33 years old. If I can do that in a couple of months, I've got it made. Alexander the Great conquers the world, dies at the height of his power. His generals break up his kingdom into four parts. Remember, we were particularly concerned with the Seleucid Empire and the Ptolemies. The Seleucids are in power sort of in Asia and Asia Minor, on east, not all the way over to India for most of the time, but pretty close to that. You remember the Ptolemies rule where? Egypt, very good, the breadbasket of the world. Now, we're going to leave those guys be for the most part for the next 2 weeks, because we're going to take 2 weeks and look at Rome as they arise. And what we're going to find out is that Rome is unlike any of the other kingdoms before. Look at Daniel. First of all, take a look at Daniel chapter 2. This is King Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And we're going to read verse 33 and then down to 40 through 43, because Daniel is explaining Nebuchadnezzar's dream to him. And remember, Nebuchadnezzar sees the gigantic statue, the head made of gold, silver, bronze, iron in the legs, and then iron and clay in the feet. And we have come to the kingdom of iron, which is Rome. Look at verse 33. its legs of iron and its feet partly of iron and clay. That's the part of the statue that represents Rome. Now skip down to verse 40, and we'll see what Daniel has to say about this fourth kingdom. There will then be a fourth kingdom as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things. So like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces, all these former kingdoms. In that you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay, partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom, but it will have in it the toughness of iron, inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with common clay. As the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong, and part of it will be brittle. And in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery. So we see a couple of things here. First, Rome, the Rome of the past. We see actually here the Rome both of the past and of the future. I believe the Rome of the past are the legs of iron. And the Rome of the future, out of which the Antichrist will come, is the feet of iron and clay. But here we have the Rome of the past as strong as iron. It crushes everything in its path, including these other great kingdoms. And we're going to see that come to pass as we consider. I have an entire page of just the conquests of Rome that we're going to talk about at the end of the morning. You guys will all be enthralled, I'm sure. But we're going to see that this is a kingdom that they destroy everyone. They kill and they conquer, and everything about Roman society was built toward being a conquering kingdom. And that's what Rome did. Come over to chapter 7 and we see Daniel's vision of the beasts. We've seen a lion that stood for the Babylonians. We've seen a bear that stood for the Medo-Persian Empire already here. We've seen a leopard who is the lightning quick Alexander the Great. And we see in chapter 7, verse 7, that after he saw these things, Daniel kept looking in his night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying, extremely strong, and it had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Skip down to verse 19. Then I desired to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its claws of bronze, which devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with his feet. Skip down to verse 23. Thus he said, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms and will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. And again, we have two iterations of this, a past kingdom of Rome and a future kingdom of Rome. But the emphasis here is clearly that Rome, compared to the other kingdoms, this is a different animal. All right? This is a different animal. It's different from the other kingdoms. All the other kingdoms had a few major leaders. They rose quickly and then they fell. But Rome has many military and civic leaders. It dominates the world for 2,000 years. Rome is one of the, if not the, major power in the world. And we see here that the characteristic of this kingdom is that it devours and it tramples. It eats and digests the other kingdoms, and the ones that it doesn't take in itself, it crushes and destroys. So before we get into some of the historical aspects of Rome, I want to ask a question. What made Rome tick? What made Rome so different? How is it that it devours these kingdoms? How is it that it crushes, unlike any other kingdom? Well, the Roman genius is that it takes the best of all of its kingdoms, all of the kingdoms that it conquers, and it makes it Roman. One of my seminary professors called Rome the Xerox Kingdom. All right, because it copies the best of everything from everyone that it takes in. And that's a little different. Uh-oh. Not right now. All right. It's a little different from from the other kingdoms that we've seen. Remember the Babylonians? What did the Babylonians do? They took the best and the brightest to Babylon, and they took those people in, and they made them serve the kingdom, right? They made them serve Babylon. The Persians just kind of let everybody be. Remember, it's under the Persians that the Jews are allowed to go back to Jerusalem, rebuild the temple, rebuild the wall. The Persians just kind of said, pay your taxes and be good. All right, the Romans are a little bit like that. But the Persians just kind of let everybody be. The Greeks tried to make everyone Greek. Right? Remember, we talked about the process of Hellenization, where they tried to, Alexander's idea was to hold his empire together by making everyone the same culturally, and by sort of ingesting everyone and making them the same or very similar. What Rome does is it takes the best from everyone and it incorporates that into the way that Rome is. Rome sort of is amoeba-like. It bends and expands and shapes based on the best things of what are brought of what are brought in. It becomes Greek in its culture. It sees, okay, well, the Greeks have a cool culture, and so that becomes the dominant culture. They build roads. I think it's the Babylonians, maybe the Persians, who had a really good road system, and the Romans recognize, oh, that's really good. That's going to be really helpful militarily. In fact, oddly enough, Rome's system of roads was so good that despite the fact that the kingdom of Rome, the empire of Rome, totally engulfs the Mediterranean Sea, and Rome has almost no navy to speak of through its entire history. There are a couple of times when there are some important battles that they have to win, so they build and train their navy up. But you would think that Rome would become a maritime power, that they would become a sea power, because, well, most all of their empire is united by the Mediterranean. But their system of roads is so good, they can move their armies wherever they want, whenever they want, and however they want, so quickly that it's not really necessary. So Rome takes the best from everybody and makes it Roman. It's also interesting the way the society is built up, the way that it's put together. It was built to breed military leaders and heroes. If you wanted to be anyone in Rome, if you wanted to advance socially in Rome, if you wanted to be the consul, that's the highest position in the Roman Republic, you had to be a general, and you had to be a good general. And if you were a good general, that means you went out and you conquered some people. And then what you got to do then was you got to take all the people back to Rome, all the people that you conquered, their leaders and everything, and you got to take all the loot that you conquered, or that you got when you conquered those people, and you got what was called a triumph in the city. You got to go through the streets of Rome, and they basically threw a really big parade. And you were the parade marshal, and you got to wave at the people and say, yes, I'm amazing, I just conquered these people, I'm great. And that's how you advance socially, even if it wasn't at the highest levels of society. That's how you went from the landowning class to the ruling class, and you could move socially in Rome as far as your social stratosphere. But it almost always had to happen through military means. And that's how you gained your wealth. That's how you gained. In fact, later on, that's even how you could become a citizen of Rome. And we've seen in the New Testament how important a thing that is. And very oftentimes that happens by being a member of the army. It was almost like at the highest levels of Roman society, it was almost like if we pass a rule in the United States that in order to become president, you had to be a general in the military, a general or an admiral. And it's almost like if we added that as a requirement for being the president of the United States. So the society was built to have its best and its brightest become military heroes. And We'll be able to see that as we move through history, move through the history of Rome, because you have general after general after general after general who is a great man, who is a brilliant general, who conquers and expands Rome, and the society of Rome becomes dependent upon this expansion. In fact, that's what begins to hurt Rome, is that in order for Rome to work, it has to continue to expand, because that's how they bring in money, that's how they bring in slaves, that's how they pay their army in loot and different things like that. So Rome is almost built to expand, and it requires that as a society. And while innovation helps, the Romans, make no mistake, they innovate with their military. They move from phalanx to a legion to just the way the army is put together and everything. They innovate militarily, but ultimately, Rome is like, I hate to say it's like Rocky, because Rocky is the underdog and Rome wasn't the underdog, but a lot of times what you see in Roman war is that Rome gets beat and beat and they get beat up and they have an army that's crushed, but what happens? They just keep sending another and another and another, and more people, and more troops, and more armies, and more conquerors, and eventually they just overwhelm the people that they fight, the kingdoms and the tribes and the peoples that they conquer. They tenaciously send army after army after army and crush any people who stand in its way. Eventually what happens is they either overwhelm them or they finally get a general to the scene who is brilliant enough, who is smart enough to figure out how to beat these people. So they change, and they'll change tactics, and they'll adjust, and they overwhelm their enemies. We've also talked a good bit about the uniting force of the different kingdoms. What is it? Remember, we talked about like Alexander and Hellenization, and he wants to make the culture the uniting thing. Well, in Rome, the secret to the iron legs is piety. Piety is the idea of doing what is right by the gods, so to speak, by serving the gods well. And this is the uniting force in Rome. It's the service of the gods and the ancestors of Rome. The Romans weren't choosy about whom they included in their pantheon. In fact, oftentimes before going into battle against a tribe or another kingdom, they would offer sacrifices to the gods of their opponents, and they would say, look, if you help us conquer these people who have worshipped you for however long, we will worship you better. We'll offer the sacrifices better. We will offer. We'll ask for auspices better. We will be more pious toward you than these people are if you help us to conquer these people. And so you see something of the mindset of the Roman. It is to do what is right by the gods, and then that's multiplied by the fact that the ultimate goddess is Rome herself. The ultimate goddess to the Roman is Rome herself. So, let me read this. There's an interesting quote from he's a Roman writer, but a later Roman writer. He's a Christian. His name was Prudentius, and he laments in his writing the way that this religious system was passed on from generation to generation to generation. This is what he said. I skip around a little bit here, but he says, to dead men glorified by legendary fame, our nation gives reverence and worship. And to our imaginary household gods, the young bowed, shuddering before anything which his hoary ancestors had designed as worshipful in their eyes. His heir, when grown, went abroad. He lost in wonder, viewed the public festivals. He's talking about this small child who at home was raised to worship the household gods, to worship his ancestors, to be pious. And then when he grows, he goes abroad to the city of Rome, lost in wonder, viewed the public festivals, saw the lofty capital, the laureled priests standing at the temple of their gods in the sacred way, before the shrine of Rome, for she too is worshipped after the fashion of a goddess. So what all this amounts to is the fact that doing your civic duty for Rome, doing what was right by the state of Rome, was not just a civic matter, but a religious matter. For the Roman, civics and religion were one and the same. And so you can imagine, as this is built into you from generation to generation to generation, that the pull becomes strong to pull your weight, to do your duty for the state. And that is the uniting factor for Rome for a very, very long time. So that's a little bit about what makes Rome tick. They take in the things that they conquer. They make to be Roman, to be that. They take the best of those things. The society is built toward military success and prowess, and to breed military leaders, and piety becomes the uniting spirit in Rome. Now, I want to touch on Rome's rise here a little bit, because it takes quite some time for the city of Rome to become the empire that it does in the day of the New Testament. Depending on what legends you believe, Rome was founded in probably the mid 8th century BC. So during the divided kingdom in Israel, the city was founded either by a man named Aeneas and the descendants of the Trojan survivors. Maybe you read in high school Virgil's Aeneid. That is the story of those survivors. That's the legend of those survivors. Or Romulus, who was the brother of Remus, legend has it, were nurtured by a she-wolf after they were abandoned on the banks of the Tiber River because of a legend that they would supplant their uncle, who was a king. But anyway, we're going to go with Romulus. The city was populated. When Romulus founds the city, he invites men of all classes, including slaves and free men, to live without distinction. And maybe you've heard of the event also of the rape of the Sabines, or the Sabine women. That's how he got wives for all of them. He invited one of the neighboring tribes in to have a party, and he abducted all their women and made them wives of all the men who had come to live there. It's one way to go about it, I suppose. But the city of Rome was built on seven hills. Maybe you've heard Rome called the city on seven hills. With the Tiber River and a ford of the Tiber River sort of to the northwest. And you can see here, here's the ford. The Tiber, you guys know we're in Italy, right? So it's like, so Rome is like halfway down the shin on the boot, if that gives you an idea of where Rome sits. And it's built on seven hills. Probably, it's initially founded on the Palatine Hill right here. And this is where the Tiber River, major river that runs through Italy, can be forded. So you can get across and you can get animals and stuff like that across. And what happens is, this is a really good location for two reasons. First of all, because of these hills, you see you have a field here and some flatter land here. Rome becomes a very defensible city. It's high land. It's high ground. Okay. The second reason that this is good is because this ford means that roads that run, I realize it doesn't look like it, but the Tiber River kind of runs east and west more than north and south. This is kind of on a jog of the river. Roads that were going this way or this way to either direction would come to this spot to ford the river, to cross the river. Okay? So it was a crossroads so to speak, of a couple of roads that would come and meet there. It was easy to defend as well. Now, early on, Rome is a monarchy. Okay, tradition has that there are seven kings elected by the people to serve for life. And again, their legend has it that this was done without military power used to keep power ever. That there were never coups or anything like that involved. Not that they didn't have military power, but they never used it to try and seize power. The king had supreme executive powers. He ran the military. He was the chief executive. He was the judicial authority. He had legislative power. The Senate and Assembly at this point had very little real power. Essentially, the king called them. He appointed them. He presided. He presented items for them to discuss. And then when they voted on it, it was advice to the king. So these men were initially elected or appointed as advisors to the king, really. He also had, and this is where the religious roots of civic power start or civic duty start, he also had the supreme priestly position. He had the sole right to auspice on behalf of Rome, that is to seek for signs from the gods. He also was the one who appointed the lower priestly offices, and he set the calendar. He said, okay, this is when we're going to celebrate our religious feasts and all of that kind of thing. The king had absolute power at this point. What happens, though, is the kingship degenerates. Eventually, one of the kings does enough to insult the nobles, the nobility, that they say, okay, we're done with the king. So they kill the king and they say, we're setting up a republic. We're going to institute a republic, and it becomes really a complicated combination of groups and individuals who enact a system of checks and balances. Okay? So what they do is they move the power all over the place, and they place powers of groups and individuals against each other to sort of even things out. Now, this is going to work for a very, very long time, to be really honest. Rome's government was really complicated, but it worked really well. What you need to know about the Republican offices, okay, the Senate is made up of the elite class. They passed advice that was followed to magistrates, and they oversaw foreign policies. There were different groups of assemblies and councils that were made up of tribal leaders from around. Those leaders elected magistrates, they enacted legislation, they acted in the interest of their constituents. And then you have a group of magistrates, individuals who are endued with different checking and balancing powers. Okay, some of the important magistrates included the consul. Okay, the consul was the highest ranking of the regular time magistrates. They essentially headed up government, and they had nearly absolute civil and military power and authority. These were the guys who served as generals. Okay, they served as generals. The tribune of the plebeians. Okay, this is another important position. The plebeians are like the masses. Okay, that's the hoi polloi, the general people. All right, and there were two tribunes of the plebs, and they represented the rights and the interests of the normal people. Okay, of the normal people, they had powers of veto over what the Senate and the consuls did. To try to balance the interests of the elite versus the interests of the big groups. And this was a very important position. And his powers weren't necessarily all that well defined, but for most of the time, traditionally, that's what he did. He had veto power. He could also introduce legislation and some different things like that. One of the things that's going to happen when the Republic falls to the Empire, when the empire takes hold, is that these tribunes, are going to use powers in a way that had never been used before. They're going to break with tradition and start to change things around. And finally, there's another office that is called dictator. Now, a dictator was entrusted with absolute power for 6 months in a time of war. In other words, and what happened when you appointed a dictator, all of the other governmental groups sort of dissolved for the 6 months, and you had one man ruling the government. You had one man overseeing all of those things. In times only when it was expedient that you have a very efficient function. Okay, when you had to have fast decisions made, and so in time of war, essentially was when this was when this position was used. Now, what happens for the majority of the time of the Republic is these powers are used very traditionally. Okay, but when the Republic falls, these powers are used in new and different ways. Okay, so you have people who say, well, I technically have the right to do this, so I'm going to use that right in order to do things that have never been done before. So the Republic lasts from the 5th century BC all the way to essentially the turn of the era. There are a couple of different proposed tipping points to the empire. Most of the time, it's the beginning of the reign of Caesar Augustus. So I think that's in 27 BC. So the Republic stands for a long time. And one more thing I want to cover. We didn't get to that whole page of conquest yet. We will here shortly. We're going to see here that Rome indeed was not built in a day. And I liked this comic. This is the foreman or whatever. And he says, well, I'll tell you right now, there's no way we're hitting this deadline. Coming soon, Rome. And it says a day. Rome wasn't built in a day. It took hundreds of years for Rome to be built up. Okay, here's Rome, right? Halfway up the shin. And initially, obviously, Rome starts out as that small little settlement on the Tiber River, on one hill of the seven hills. And the earliest Roman wars, and this is where the crushing starts, okay? The earliest Roman wars are fought to expand into this area, and then down into here, up into here, and eventually, by about 275 BC, Rome controls the Italian peninsula. Just to give you a couple ideas here, or an idea of how that expansion happened, in 450 to about 400, you have the earliest conquest of their immediate neighbors. There are three groups of people who live on Italy, or on the Italian peninsula. You have the Etruscans. They're up here. Let me look back down here. The Latins, who are in the region here, and also then the Sabines. And Rome initially fights against those three groups and expands into the spots here that are red. Okay, into these red areas here. They fight in 343 to 282, the Samnite Wars, a group called the Samnites, and then they take sort of down here to the ankle of the boot, all the way back here to the eastern part. But where Rome then really makes the transition from a local group, so they control by about 282 BC, they control all of this area in here. In 280, from 280 to 275 BC, they fight what are called the Pyrrhic Wars. All right, I'm going to throw a lot of wars and stuff like that at you, but just know that Rome crushes. Okay? But the Pyrrhic Wars are important because this is where Rome makes the transition to an international power. All right? Who's over here? Greece, right? And we know Greece is strong. They're cool. They've got the Spartans and all of that. Greece has settlements here in the foot of the boot. So this is primarily dominated by the Greeks. Well, at one point, in about 280 BC, there is a diplomatic disagreement between the Romans and one of the groups here in the foot, in the Greek foot of the boot, and it comes to blows, all right? They start to fight each other. The Greeks call over here, and we can't quite see it in this picture, but they call over to a king named Pyrrhus, who rules a kingdom here, a Greek kingdom in the northwestern part of Greece. And he comes, he brings an army over, and they fight with the Romans. Now, Pyrrhus wins, okay? He keeps winning battles, but he wins battles and takes huge losses, huge casualties, all right? And eventually what he figures out is that this is not a tenable position, okay? He says he comes to understand, I can't hold these positions in Italy. And so because he loses so many people and so many people and so many people, even while he wins these battles, he pulls out. And what that tells the world is that, okay, Rome can fight with the big boys now, right? This is actually where, have you heard the term a Pyrrhic victory? It describes a victory where you lose, Eric gives me a thumbs up, describes a victory where you lose so much that you actually, a win where you lose so much that you actually lose in the long term. This is where we get that term, a Pyrrhic victory. Pyrrhus has to fall back. He goes back into Greece, and the world is on notice now that Rome can hold its own with the big boys, all right, with the powers that be. They gain an international military reputation, and at this point, they really are beginning to dominate. They're really beginning to dominate the Italian peninsula. They also make gains up here in northern Italy, and so, excuse me, by the 3rd century BC, by about 250, 280 BC, 275, they control Italy, and they're sort of a world power. Now, next week we'll pick up with what's called the Punic Wars, all right? And you can see Carthage is right down here. This, you guys know what continent this is? This is Africa, okay? So northern Africa, they're going to come to blows. This is the island of Sicily. Where Rome really starts to expand is Rome is friends with some people on Sicily, and Carthage is friends with some people on Sicily. The people on Sicily start to fight. Rome comes to help their friends. Carthage comes to help their friends. And that'll lead to a guy named Hannibal coming from the north. And we'll talk about that. But Rome will expand greatly in the Punic War. So we'll pick up there next week. We'll try and finish up Rome next week. And then we'll get back to the New Testament in just a couple weeks. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much for our time together this morning. Just ask that you would bless our time of fellowship and worship now. Pray that you would be honored and that you would be pleased by the worship that we offer. Lord, we love you. We thank you for the blessings that you have bestowed on us, that you have given to us. Thank you for your Son, for sending him to die for us. And we worship and pray now in his name. Amen.